So settling into your meditation posture. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And with this conversation, maybe just checking in with how you're feeling. It's challenging to be with the feeling of not being safe. And of course, none of us are physically threatened, so we are in that sense safe. And now that I've locked the meeting, as long as you trust everyone who's here, you can relax. And breathe. And let the breath fill you, calm you, settle you. So tonight, maybe to return to just the most essential kind of basic elements of our practice. The breath, feeling the body, and noticing the thoughts that distract the mind. Each thought we have is unique in the sense that it's just happening right now, and it's never happened before. And yet our thoughts follow patterns. Each of us has our own habits of thought. We can start to see those patterns and disidentify. That is, just see them as words and images in the mind, not as belonging to you, not as expressions of who you are, just conditioned habits, conditioned patterns. And pretty quickly, we start to watch our thoughts, these patterns reveal themselves. And it can also be pretty clear how they are related to our personality, to our history, towards our, to our story. It's natural that we identify these things, the personality, the history, the story, as being who we are. But if we look closely, we see that there is no substance in them. They are just patterns. They are just dependently arising patterns, conditioned patterns. The less we identify with these patterns, the less we suffer. Really, a principle of the Dharma. the more we sit and watch and settle, the more we develop a distance from the thoughts, the more they seem like just empty words and images appearing, passing through the mind. In those moments of calm, we have an intuitive understanding of the emptiness of self. We might not use those words to describe the experience. That's essentially what's happening. Awareness itself becomes the dominant experience, and the objects of awareness take on less significance, less space. There's no identity with pure awareness, just knowing, just being. Well, I went from saying, let's just do the basics of meditation to talking about emptiness and not self. So that evolved a little bit sometimes. I don't necessarily have a plan when I'm leading the meditation. So, I still was, thinking about how disoriented a bit disoriented and uncomfortable. I'm still feeling a bit tonight, and really remembering when we started this class. It was the first night was March 13th, Friday, March 13th, 2020. And that was the first night that Spirit Rock canceled my live class. And so I quickly had set up a Zoom class. And that first night, it was really hard for me to teach. I didn't really feel comfortable teaching on Zoom yet. And so it was that weekend that I decided I would use one breath at a time to just kind of give me something to ground my teaching in. So it was that Monday, then the 16th, when they started the kind of lockdown in the Bay Area. And in any case, I felt mostly comfortable since then, but I'll be okay. I'm sure we'll all be okay. It's just interesting, when you've been sober for a long time, like one thing is that, like, you start to wonder why people drink or why people are like take drugs and stuff. Like, why do they do that? Like, you sort of lose touch with it, right? And the same somewhat as a sort of Buddhist practitioner, and like, trying to be mindful and compassionate or whatever. And, certainly not that I've achieved any great, enlightenment, but there is a way in which I kind of live in this bubble of, it feels safe. And, the idea that people are running around with automatic weapons, and then just killing people, and people are saying that's okay, just like, yeah, I mean, I kind of like it down here in my basement. I'll just say that. It's like, I might just stay down here. It's okay. It is still a crazy world, and getting bombed like that, Zoom bombed, is like that. It feels like that intrusion of that madness that I know is out there, but that most of the time I can sort of think of as far away. If I was talking on Tuesday about a spiritual awakening, because we're on step 12. And so I had decided to go to my workbook, Buddhism and the 12 Steps workbook, which has a section that kind of talks about each step having an element of spiritual awakening in it. And there's the sort of main body of that section, which is called Spiritual Awakening, and starts on page 227 for those who might be interested. The main body of it is about step one, kind of And how transformative that is, even though, you know, the term spiritual awakening is only in step 12. But this idea that we can look at each step as being having some element of awakening. So then I have kind of a list, a bullet list of the steps. Step 2 awakens us to the possibility of change. Yeah, because, you know, one of the aspects of being an addict is being stuck and feeling as if you can't change, you know, feeling hopeless. And the idea that we can change is vital, because as long as we don't believe we can change, we won't do the things that are involved in changing. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And you know, I was writing today about the Four Noble Truths, and the third noble truth, you know, carries a similar message. It's the truth of the end of suffering, and the truth that suffering can end if we let go. Step 3 awakens us to commitment and acceptance. So this list isn't meant to be definitive, but really just sort of some thoughts. I think you could find your own, and I think it's a good idea. In fact, the next section, the next exercise asks, what is spiritual awakening for you? So these are just thoughts that came to me when I was writing this book, not the end of it, but... Because step 3, you know, which says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. You know, people interpret that in a lot of different ways. But the way I see it, I guess the primary things that I see commitment, because we made a decision to do this. And it's deciding to really take on this life of recovery. And then acceptance is the turning it over part, saying, okay, I'm going to do my best out of that commitment, but I'm not going to expect that I can control the results. I'm not going to fight with the results. Step 4 awakens us to our failings. So the searching and fearless moral inventory, which certainly, I didn't realize the extent of my failings until I did that step. So that was definitely an awakening, but somewhat of a rude awakening, as they say. But, you know, without that, real change can't happen, right? We have to see ourselves. This is the, you know, such a kind of key element of recovery and all kinds of spiritual growth, is that willingness to look at the painful realities, and particularly to look at our own failings, and to have the humility to look at them, and to have really the maturity and the to some extent sort of emotional strength, because it can be really disturbing. And frankly, you know, my own avoidance of acknowledging those feelings was very much out of my own emotional weakness. I don't really like that phrase. But out of, you know, fear of being a bad person, you know, and some need to not be bad. I'm not saying it well. I imagine some of you will have better ways of saying that. Step 5 awakens us to the power of confession. It's an interesting take on it. Step 5 is when we share the searching for fearless moral inventory of step 4. So, I mean, that's certainly something we get out of step 5, is like, realize, wow, when I'm honest with people, it's really freeing, you know. For me, just as much as sharing my inventory, just learning to share in meetings became just such a powerful healing for me and got me through so many hard times. Step six awakens us to the power of intention. So I'm not sure that that's obvious, but it's the way I see step six as an intention step. We are entirely willing to have God remove these defective character. That willingness is the intention. And the Buddha talks about how it's intention that really informs our karma. So it's becoming aware of intention is really important, because there's always intention behind actions, behind speech, even behind thoughts. And we need to have clarity around that. Or even though we think we're doing the right thing, if we're not seeing honestly our intention, we can be acting unskillfully. Interesting now in the diversity work these days, which is, opened up so much wisdom, the idea of being aware of the difference between intention and impact is, worth probably mentioning at this point, and seeing that intention is not enough to guarantee a beneficial result from something, that we still need to stay in that feedback loop of paying attention to the impact of our behaviors, or in our speech particularly, to see whether our intentions are being fulfilled in a positive way, or whether we're missing something. Because even if we have a wise intention, it doesn't mean that we understand how someone else is going to hear something or feel about it. And we can't just hide behind intention as a way of avoiding responsibility for any impact. Complicated, and I don't want to suggest that's a simple equation. Because we're also not responsible for the way people, receive things. Yeah. So anyway, step seven awakens us to the power of letting go. Step eight awakens us to the truth of who we harmed. Very revealing when we make the list of those we harmed. Step nine awakens us to the power of forgiveness. Super powerful, super amazing experience, freeing experience to make amends to people and to learn to make amends, to live as a person who is willing to make amends. Step 10 awakens us to the importance of enduring effort. That's a pretty nice way of saying that, since step 10 kind of reiterates steps 4 through 9, says continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. So it's that it's got the inventory and it's got the amends within it. So it's really pointing to the fact that we need to continue to do this work. So enduring effort is a nice way of phrasing that, if I do say so. Step 11 awakens us to our inner goodness and spiritual life. Wow, that's I haven't read this in a while, so I'm like, that's nice. Step 11 obviously does a lot of things, but that's a nice piece of it. Step 12 awakens us to service and commitment, carrying the message and practicing these principles in all our affairs. So then the exercise that follows says, what is spiritual awakening to you? Reflect first on the meaning of spiritual, which is a good one to think about. Then consider how you understand the term spiritual awakening. Finally, reflect on the ways that you have awakened spiritually. Nice topic. So I will open it up for thoughts, questions, comments. Happy to hear from anyone who would like to join in tonight. Wow, I'm impressed. You guys are such good meditators that you just can't break your silence.
Good to see you, Kevin.
Oh, hi, Dana.
Hi. This is, I don't know, maybe off topic, but this is what's on my mind. Do you know the book, The Giving Tree?
I've heard of it.
So there's like debate out there whether it's extreme compassion or extreme codependence. So I just wanted your thoughts, but if you're not familiar with it, maybe someone else. I don't know. That's just something I keep coming back to because I struggle.
What's your with take?
Those two things. I don't know. As a parent, now that I'm a parent, it seems like that's what you do.
Right.
And it seems like extreme service and, you know, what 12 is about. Being there for the happiness of, you know, others. But see, that gets so commingled with codependence. Mm. So I was trying to think, well, did he harm the tree? Was the tree sad? You know, was the tree abused? But as the boy grew up, the tree served a different purpose for him. At the end, the tree is just literally like, I think, a stump.
Hmm.
But he sits on it, you know. I think that's how it ends. So I don't know why that's been on my mind, but didn't know how other people, if other people thought about that or not. But I miss you. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. You're up late. Kids are asleep. Right. Yeah, well, you know, it's a perennial question. You know, Barbara West wrote an essay asking the question, you know, what's the difference between a bodhisattva and a codependent? And she's somebody who identifies as codependent, and she's a nurse, you know, which is sort of a, you know, refuge for the codependents, the nursing world. And I think it mostly comes back to intention. But we know, like with our children, that there's a point at which helping them stops being helpful, you know. And yet, certainly when they're small and they're vulnerable, you know, we have to do everything for them. And you know, as they grow, you know, that part of their job is to teach us to back off, you know. But if that relationship is not, you know, totally healthy, then yeah, it can become this one in which you're trying to take care of these people who really should be taking care of themselves. Not a simple question. I've met more than once with parents of addicts who were asking me for guidance in terms about how to treat their adult addict children. And most of the time, you know, after hearing them out of what's been going on, I've had to say, you know, you probably need to just stop helping them in any way. Because as we know, you know, hitting bottom as an addict, you know, that's as far as it seems to work. That's how people seem to find their way into recovery, if they find their way at all. And if somebody can keep getting by, by through the support of an enabling parent, then they can avoid hitting that bottom. But anyway, I don't mean to lecture about that. It's not always that simple either. Steve, hello.
Hello, Kevin. You just answered a lot of my questions that I was thinking about, because being a codependent, I think for me, spiritual awakening is something I'm not really sure exactly what that means to me. I know that I've kind of looked for that all my life. And I used to think that I would be awakened spiritually if I just had clarity of mind and my consciousness was all smooth and even. And I'm realizing now through the study and through all these readings I'm doing and the meditating, that just ain't going to happen. That doesn't happen. You know, the mind is just going to do what it wants to do. And so that in itself is, to me, my spiritual awakening is to understand that and work with it. And so I just recently, you know, I've been codependenting my daughter for 35 years. She's an addict, alcoholic, and I'm catching myself doing that a little bit with her son, who you all know I'm raising my grandson, who's 15. And he seems to grow up a little bit more every day, you know, a little more defiant, a little more cocky, he gets taller. And it's amazing what how fast he's growing up. So for me, spiritual awakening is understanding the dynamic of my consciousness through the meditation process and through the Buddha's teachings and going back into other spiritual traditions. You know, I read Richard Rohr's stuff every day and how they're connected. And they're talking a lot lately about Christianity, Jesus, and the Buddha, and it's just wonderful stuff. So for me, my spiritual awakening is just relaxing around my own craziness. And it seems to, I'm making progress, if that makes any sense.
As long as it makes sense to you, Steve. You're good.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting, yeah, that, you know, I was talking last time about, you know, Jack Kornfield's essay called Enlightenments, Plural, and how he describes these different traditions that have different definitions of what spiritual awakening or enlightenment is, and what defines it, how it manifests. So, yeah, I like having a broad view of this.
Yeah.
I'm fairly much steeped in Theravadan Buddhism, and there's like a very kind of specific description of these stages of awakening, which, you know, is a pretty remarkable model. But it's also, it feels pretty inaccessible in a way, particularly the advanced stages, you know. And so it's important for me to see that there are other aspects and other varieties of spiritual awakening that are happening, just in terms of, you know, my own self-esteem, you know, just my own sense of like, well, I've done all this work and it's like, did I get anything out of it? What's the deal? I want my awakening, you know. And again, because I think there's a tendency, I certainly have the tendency to sort of devalue, you know, where I'm at. And you meditate, and as you say, you know, all this crap goes through your mind, and you think, well, I'm not enlightened, you know, I got all this crap in my mind. And it turns out that realizing that you have a lot of crap in your mind is an aspect of waking up, right?
Exactly. Like, exactly.
Most people don't even know that they have crap in their mind, which is the real right. problem. You know, if you know it's crap, hey, you're like, you're on your way. You know?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. You just do it more eloquently.
Well, I don't know. Crap is not the most eloquent thing I've ever said, but, you know. So, Jeffrey, nice you could make it.
Happy to be here. So two quick observations, because I don't want to take up too much space. The first is there's a recorded interchange from a talk that the Dalai Lama gave in Los Angeles, where an African-American narcotics detective from the LAPD, Sheriff's Department, I don't know, one of those, talked about the difficulty of dealing with all of the dukkha that was in his world, and how he felt like sometimes he could not be compassionate, and that sometimes that he was working against what he had learned about Buddhism. And the Dalai Lama told him that when you interrupt the bad action of the criminal involved or the accused right. involved, when he is imprisoned, you not only are being compassionate to the community because that person will no longer harm them, but you're also preventing him by imprisoning him right. from harming himself. Yeah. And he added, and the Dalai Lama added, you cannot find a Buddhist dominated country that doesn't have jails. Yeah. It's, you know, and so that this is a reflection about what happened on the last, for me, this is a reflection of what happened on the last Zoom call. There's, you know, this system that we've had to go through, and the difficulty I had getting in, difficulty maybe others had getting in. This is to prevent harm to ourselves and others, you know. And you can't run the world. The second right. little thing is one of your colleagues at Spirit Rock said something that changed my view of the spiritual awakening. He said something along the lines of, not an exact quote, so something along the lines of that becoming aware that your day-to-day life and your spiritual life are one in the same is perhaps the greatest and simplest of all spiritual awakenings. Thank you. That's all. I'll take no more.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's step 12, last line of step 12, right? Practice these principles in all our affairs, not just when we're meditating or when we're at a meeting or when we're working with a sponsee or something, you know. Yeah. Yeah. And what that means, you know, that it doesn't mean being nice to everybody. as you're suggesting, the Dalai Lama was kind of saying, it's like, yeah, because when he says you're protecting that person, the criminal, from themselves, he's also saying you're keeping them from creating more bad karma for themselves. Yeah, right. And so by not allowing people to Zoom bomb us, we're helping people. Well, I don't know. Presumably they'll find somewhere else, but if we help them to stop, we're keep helping them to not create more bad karma for themselves. I need more help here, folks. Come on. Aren't there any? How about some? Well, no, we okay. For a second there, I was thinking women. We have had a woman speak. Is someone speaking? Is that Matt?
Hi. Good to see you again, Kevin. Step four, taking a personal inventory without beating ourselves up. Could we relate that to self-acceptance or accepting the way I am, warts and all? You know, how does taking a thorough inventory relate to self-acceptance? I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Oh, I think the challenge is, and I think I was sort of alluding to this, the challenge is to have the strength of, I don't know what, the emotional strength to see that in yourself. And, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, we might, you know, see that our thoughts and feelings and even our past are not who we are, that there isn't a self that's done bad things. It's more just bad things have been done, more sort of passive voice, which doesn't mean we're not taking responsibility, but means in terms of this, the taking it on emotionally and judging ourselves. I mean, the bottom line is that's not helpful. You know, the whole point of the steps is to get to a place where we can, I'm going to say what the whole point of the steps is. So ultimately to realize our greatest potential as human beings, I would say that's, I'll make that claim at this moment. And if we are undermining ourselves and judging ourselves, then we're not going to be supporting that growth into our potential. Nonetheless, if we don't take that inventory, if we avoid it, we're also not going to realize our potential, because we're not going to see the truth. We're not going to, if we're going to change, we have to understand what the things that need to change are. You know, we have to do that investigation. How do we know in step 7 what the, you know, qualities, what the things that need to be removed are, if we haven't done the inventory? So we have to see it as a process, as part of that process. So it's definitely one of the really challenging moments in the step process. But I do think that if we develop that capacity to be honest and to accept our failings and to see ourselves as simply human and thereby flawed, because all humans are flawed and imperfect, then we can make the most of that, and rather than getting caught in some other round of self-hatred and self-judgment because we were so bad, as if our inventory was somehow worse than anyone else's. I mean, that's another kind of egotism, right? It's a negative form of egotism. I was the worst alcoholic. It's like, yeah, no way. There's always worse. Monica, I saw your hand up and now I don't see it. Did you want to say something? Oh yeah, now I see it.
I took it down. I don't know what I want to say after all, but that when I was able to talk to Anne after Tuesday, and we were talking about rain, and Tara Brock, recognize, accept, investigate, non-identity. That's been kind of sticking with me, you know, like that, as bad as that situation was traumatizing, that it was, I could, you know, kind of practice non-identity. Maybe for me, that's spiritual awakening, you know.
Yeah.
I know that before I had these tools, I wouldn't have been able to stop. I would have been gone, it happened to me. Yeah. You know, don't you know this has happened to me, and you know, beat my chest and be the victim. Whereas you know, now I have these new tools through study and practice, and I'm still kind of, I still feel kind of like an infant, but at least that was a kind of an aha moment when I could use that tool. I don't really know if there's a question in it, but you know, I just, it's kind of,
yeah, well, I mean, what it makes me think of is, yeah, I that was traumatizing. I mean, there's no other word that I can come up with. It was traumatizing. And, you know, it was just a thing that was happening on a computer screen in front of me, you know, rather, it wasn't like somebody stabbing me or, you know, it wasn't personal. It was just something horrible that I had to see and be involved in. But, you know, and yeah, indeed, I still can feel it and there's still some resonance from it, but I don't think that it's like, as you're suggesting, it's like, let me not like blow it up into something that I'm going to carry with me and be telling, you know, identify with, and it's my story about me because it's my group after all. So they did attack me and, you know, and all of that. I think I have to just trust in impermanence, as time passes, that effect will fade as long as I take care of myself. And of course, I'm not going to keep sort of trying to remember it, you know, like I'll try not to go review it for me myself, but you know, it's just another wound in life, you know, and it, that I have to kind of hold with, you know, hold myself with kindness and recognize, not trivialize it, you know, recognize it. Wow, I'm feeling this, and you know, in a way, it's like, wow, I should have gotten over it or what? No, I haven't. There's a feeling there, but also I do believe that will pass, that, you know, in the next couple of weeks, it'll just kind of become like an icky memory rather than something that I can kind of feel as I do in my body now. So yeah. Yeah. Thank you. So let me just open to Dan for our last comment tonight. Hi, Dan.
Hi. So I hope this is okay. And I've never, like, in this meeting ever had like a feeling of frustration, but I kind of do with like this conversation tonight. Mm-hmm. I totally agree that people should feel safe and have a right to safety. And I wasn't there. I didn't experience it. I'm sure like it was, as people describe it, like really traumatic. And I'm saying all that really just to make a simple statement, like I didn't like the idea of like locking the meeting out. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want someone,
right,
to be, just because like something happened there 5 minutes late or something, they wouldn't even be able to like have access to the entire meeting.
Yeah. I completely understand and essentially agree with you. And I probably will not continue to do that. But tonight, I literally just did not feel comfortable. It was very weird. It was like, because normally, you know, when I guide the meditation, I'm just like, I kind of cruise into it and I feel really good. And I felt like I was just trying to guide a meditation. Like, what do I say? What do I do? You know, it's just like my chest kind of tight. And so I sort of did it just for my own selfish purposes tonight, but I absolutely want this, you know, as I said, I mean, I want this to be something that somebody can just come to my website and click and they're in. So now we have like a little bit of a barrier, but we will, I will plan to not lock the meeting in the future unless something happens where, you know,
sure. And, you know, I don't think it was just your own selfish. I mean, I'm projecting.
No, I mean, I'm just saying like that. I felt that need. And, I, you know, I mean, I figured other people did, too. I mean, I've been in meetings that had like a quick kind of Zoom bomb where there was some like crazy thing that dropped in and then left. This was not like that.
Okay.
This was obscene and racist and horrible. There was horrible audible sounds that were just, you know, grating, screeching sounds. It was very disturbing, more than just a like, you know, I've seen like weird faces come up and stuff. No, this was obscene and racist, among other things. And that was like, because the chat got taken over with racist.
But you, I mean, you also have you probably feel also a responsibility to keep.
I do feel a certain responsibility. I'm not codependent enough to think that I am in control, but yeah, absolutely. I hate that happened in something where people are coming to me, for something and want to feel safe. And then they're not safe. It sucks. Debbie, you wanted to chime in at the here?
Yeah, I did just want to kind of chime in, because it just on this whole thing, because it is a very disturbing experience, and I have experienced it before, and I had to, you know, co-host a couple other meetings after that, you know, this last week, and I did not meditate at all. I was in that way. I was watching every single person who came in. I was just, you know, it's just really raw and fresh. Yeah. And it does, it's like a wound that just takes a little bit of time to get over. Yeah. And we each need to be able to process it in the way that serves, you know, our well-being, and then as well as a group. We're a group, we're a Sangha here. So if we can be compassionate with ourselves as we go through this, it's not going to stay just like it is right now forever, you know.
Right. Yeah.
It's a process. We'll get through it. Yeah. And anyway.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, and you know, can we feel compassion for somebody who holds so much anger and hatred and really some kind of delusion that they want to behave like that, you know? And they don't realize that they probably don't even realize that they've chosen to attack a group of people who are devoted to a spiritual path and devoted to their own, you know, recovery, and to, you know, it's really like the karma. It's really bad karma to like kill somebody in Buddhism, but if you kill like a monk or if you kill a Buddha, is like really bad karma. So I feel like they've, you know, really created, it's even kind of worse karma for them that they attacked people who are wholesome. And so may they be free from suffering, and may they be free from hatred and the delusion that driving them to behave in ways that are so harmful. So thank you all for showing up and making the effort to show up. And, you know, I will be back on Tuesday morning, and we will continue with step 12 for a while. Thanks, you guys. Have a great weekend. Be safe.